Welcome back to Coast AM. Have you figured out the theme yet to the music? Have you done it? Follow me on Twitter at J Church Radio. I'm curious who's smart, and nobody is even close. And the clues are right here. They're right in front of you. And part of it is Daniel Sheehan. All right. We're going to be taking your calls right after this break. Everything is jammed up. I will promise I will get to everybody's calls tonight. Now, the point is with this show, if you live your life, and this is how I do it, it's family, friends, country. And sometimes we have to sit back and just wonder, you know, there is something going on. There is something funky, and I can't figure it out. Daniel Sheehan is helping answer all of those questions tonight. More with Daniel, taking your calls right after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast. Our guest tonight, Daniel Sheehan, and we are talking about the lost and forgotten history that led the U.S. into Iraq, the confusion, the Saudi royal family, and why and how we got there. It's a long walk through history, but we did it. And Daniel, let's go. Let's do this. We've got a lot of calls right in front of us. And cool. I'm gonna go in order here. The longest. Okay. Let's go to Steve in Kansas, wild card Steve. Thank you for holding.
Well, thank you, Jimmy, and thank you, Daniel. Daniel, I have a question for you. In your interpretation, what really was the incentive behind the Red Scare of the 1920s with Attorney General Mitchell Palmer and the then President Woodrow Wilson?
What happened, you need to remember that Woodrow Wilson became very, very sick while he was in office. And in fact, was out of functioning for a long time. And Robert Lansing, the fellow that I'd mentioned, who was the son-in-law of John W. Foster, the former Secretary of State under Benjamin Harrison, in charge of the kind of imperialist period, that Robert Lansing realized that the Bolsheviks in Russia, it were generating an entire consciousness around the planet of people being upset with the capitalist system and the bankers and the major corporations, et cetera. And they were calling for a more egalitarian set of policies. And what happened is that during that time with Palmer, and remember, that's where J. Edgar Hoover started as well. What they were doing is they were following the lead of these robber barons and the people at Brown Brothers Harriman and Sullivan and Cromwell, et cetera, saying, look, we've got to suppress any of the people who are socialists. Anybody who that we had going in the United States, starting from 1878, we had a thing called the Chautauqua Movement. And the Chautauqua Movement was originated by the United Board of Homeland Ministries of the United Methodist Church. And there were a whole series of tent revivals and speeches going on with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Clarence Darrow and Eugene Debs. There were a whole bunch of people that were going around the country basically providing seminars about what was wrong with what the robber barons were doing.
What about the legitimate threat from Comintern, the attempt to communize the entire globe? Was that not a legitimate threat to the security of the United States?
Excellent question, Stephen. Thank you.
What I'm saying is that when Russia became Stalinist, there was a period of time from 1917. Up until World War II, when the effort on the part of the socialists out in the Soviet Union were to attempt to challenge the illegitimacy of certain of the policies of the people that we've talked about. What happened, however, and very unfortunately, the Stalinists rose into power and purged almost all of those people that were socialist as distinct from authoritarian communists. And after a period of time, there became a major dialectical confrontation between the capitalist people that we've talked about and the Stalinists in the Soviet Union. And that became a flat-out dialectical confrontation between the two of them, getting into who struck John and taking turns of outdoing each other on being spies and spy versus spy, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, right after World War One, in that entire period of the 1920s, when the Palmer raids were undertaken and Jagger Hoover rose to power, there was not a serious threat in the United States on the part of any kind of a foreign power. There was, in fact, the rise in the United States of labor union movements, women's suffrage, black civil rights. Those were a lot of the people that were being targeted by the Palmer raids and by J. Edgar Hoover. That you need to understand that there is a fascist element that has been trying to dominate the United States throughout that entire period. And what they did is they eventually started identifying everything as being communist in its origin. The feminist movement was communist. The environmental movement was communist. The black civil rights movement was communist. That anybody who basically read more than two books a year were characterized as communist. And you got this extreme program going with the Smith Act that all rose out of the Palmer raids and Attorney General Palmer and his enemies list that eventually rose up into the McCarthy committees in the House Un-American Activities Committee that basically started attacking anybody who was critical of this element, this 1% element in the country. So
let me jump
that's
in.
The bottom line.
Yeah, let me jump in, Daniel. Thank you for the call. Thank you so much. Let's go straight to east of the Rockies with Bill in Lakeshore, Maryland. Bill, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, Jimmy. How you doing? Hi, Daniel.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, one of the things I heard in the first hour that kind of concerned me, you basically said that you talked Jimmy Carter into taking the Shaw out.
No. Here's what we did. That Stu Eisenstadt was his chief policy guy, and he had an office in DuPont Circle. I was at the Jesuit National Headquarters at 1717 Mass Ave, right off DuPont Circle. I went over and sat down and talked with Stu Eisenstadt about all different candidates in both parties, and he said that, look, if you can get the heads of the religious denominations, the 54 major religious denominations in the United States, together at a meeting, I'll get Jimmy Carter, the candidate, to come and talk with them because he's kind of this Christian type of guy. And so we got him to come over to see us all, and we all sat down and had a long discussion about what one single thing we thought could be most effective if he were elected president. And what we decided is that if he would agree that he would withdraw U.S. military funding for any person who was an authoritarian dictator who had been established to be systematically violating the human rights of his own citizens, that the United States would refrain from providing military funding to that dictator. And that's what happened. And so that it was established that Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua was doing that he was disappearing thousands of people, torturing them in torture dens. Same thing of the Shah of Iran. The Shah of Iran had this SAVAK, which was this deadly secret military police. And the problem was is that he had destroyed almost all of the moderate opposition to him, the democratic forces that were available in the country. And so that he basically eliminated almost everybody except for the fundamentalists, the Muslim fundamentalists. And so therefore when we ended up finally persuading the Carter administration to remove military funding for both Anastasio Somoza and for the Shah of Iran, in Iran, the Muslim clerics were the only sort of remaining alternative governing force in the country, and that's what. And then they ascended into power.
That makes sense. Thank you for the call, Bill. And let's go to west of the Rockies, Harriet in San Diego. Harriet, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Thanks, Jimmy, and thanks, David Sheehan, for pulling the truth out and letting us look at it once again. And pieces of the puzzle are really falling into place for me. I've done a lot of reading. I even had someone from the aristocracy of another country tell me some things, and now it's all falling in place. It looks like to me we're following the activities of an economic hitman. We go in there, we start the problem.
John Perkins, yeah.
Yeah, we build everything. We get all the money for it. It's a lot about money. And I'm surprised that Cheney got away with what he got away with. You told it all very succinctly, very quickly. It was very, very easy to follow. My question is, are the great minds working on this? Is it too late, or are they too corrupt? And, I mean, those are hard questions, but I'm going to ask.
Well, yeah, no, I think that we're in a very interesting point right now. Again, because we've come to the end of the Cold War, and that it clearly is not working anymore to simply brand people as communists if they happen to be critical of this 1%. And now they've miscued by going over and attempting to invade and occupy the Middle Eastern oil fields, and they've totally miscalculated the degree of resistance on the part of the fundamentalist Islamic people that are there, the Muslim Brotherhood. It's just like they miscalculated about the Viet Cong in Vietnam and tried to characterize them as communists, whereas Ho Chi Minh and the people had been opposing Japanese imperialism, French imperialism, and then they resisted American imperialism. And so that we're at this point right now where they've gotten themselves into a very weak position, and they're like the typical gorilla who's got his hand in a box and he's holding on to the banana, and he can't get his hand out of the box because the banana is too big to pull through the hole.
Right.
He won't let go of the banana.
Right.
And so that the bottom line is that this 1% has gotten themselves in real trouble in the Middle East by what they've done, like they got themselves in trouble in Vietnam, just like the French got in trouble in Algeria. You know, that there are places when an elite 1% starts to control the policies of a given government, they can pressure the government into doing things for their own self-interest that turn out to be extremely dumb in the choices they make, because it hasn't been subjected to democratic criticism. And these people are at a very weak point right now. And they've also driven our entire economic system to the point where the corporations are contaminating the environment with global greenhouse gas emissions, with, you know, spending billions of dollars growing cattle, you know, for Burger King and McDonald's, you know, down in the equatorial areas of the planet, and burning down tens of thousands of acres of trees that produce the oxygen for the planet. And now even Francis, the Pope of the Catholic Church, has issued a papal encyclical. And it's important, Harriet, you should get a look at this papal encyclical. It's called On the Common Care of Our Home, or On the Care of Our Common Home. He points out not only that, in fact, the transnational corporations are responsible for the proximate cause of this global climate change, he points out that the very nature of these major capitalist corporations that have escaped from any kind of legal liability of the owners of these companies, that they're out of control, and they're generating an entire system, an economic system on the planet that has got these terrible consequences that they're palming off on to everybody else. And he's pointed out that they're generating a false worldview, that these corporations are indoctrinating people into believing that there's no inherent value in themselves other than what it is that they own, and how much property they own, and what kind of newest gadgets that they all own. And that Pope Francis pointed out that this worldview is what he calls a post-modern worldview, of destroying any kind of basis for believing anything anymore. That they're attacking not only Christianity and Jewish religions, but they're attacking any kind of value system that can place absolute value on human beings. And he's called us all to participate in a major conversation. In this additional letter that he wrote, it's called a papal exhortation, and it's called Evangelii Gaudium, is the Latin term for it. But it's the joy of the good news, and the bottom line is that there's a call that's been issued now by the Vatican and by all of the major religious leaders to say, look at. Let's try to really understand what is wrong with what it is that the country is doing. You know, let's be clear about this 1% and what they're doing, how they're getting us in trouble in the Middle East, how they've occupied the Middle East, how they've tortured people. They've taken people into custody and put them in Guantanamo that have been innocent and then refused to let them go because they said, we've held these innocent people in jail for 15 years and now they hate us. And so they're too dangerous to release. I mean, you've got to understand these people are irresponsible. And that we've got to think clearly about what the alternative worldview is that does in fact place absolute value on individual human beings, to place value on affection and care and compassion for other people. It's not just the Judeo-Christian social ethic. There's an entire human ethos that we need to be very clear about and to be able to articulate. And Jimmy raised at the beginning of the show the fact that I just got back from Rome, where I went to the Vatican and was visiting with Father Jose Gabriel Fuentes. He has said that, look, in light of the discovery of more and more and more of these planets around these stars in our galaxy, that we're going to sooner than later encounter some other highly technological civilization, but is distinctly a non-human civilization. We need to come to grips with who we really are as human beings. You know, what are our values? What are our beliefs? What are our sense of our own real value? So that when we encounter another civilization that may be 2 million to 3 million years in advance of us, that they've evolved far, way farther than we have, so that we're not the most intelligent, we're not the most spiritually developed, we're not the most sophisticated species in the whole universe. We've got to understand what our real value is so that our culture, our human culture, doesn't disappear. You know, that historically, when a major, highly technologically developed civilization encounters a primitive civilization down in the jungles of South America or in New Guinea or something like this, their whole culture falls apart because they haven't reflected upon what their real source of their values are, and so their whole culture gets dissolved when they encounter some more sophisticated culture. We don't want this to happen to us. So we need to, at the same time, we need to be responding to Pope Francis's call to understand what our worldview is that places real absolute value on human beings. And at the same time, we have to know what it is that makes us valuable, even in comparison to other people who may have a whole civilization that has lots of technological developments, but that we have certain qualities as human beings that make us ultimately valuable.
Let me jump in. We're going to be up against a break tonight. Daniel Sheehan, we are discussing the lost and forgotten history between the United States and the Middle East. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. More with Daniel Sheehan and your calls right after this. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Listen, I have a show. It's called Fade to Black. That show you can listen to. Go and find me Monday through Thursday, 7 to 10, right before George. It's the best way to listen to George. I'm the warm-up. Go check it out. Fade to Black. JimmyChurchRadio.com. Let's get right back to it. I'm going to get everybody's calls in. All of your questions for Daniel Sheehan right after this short break. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Let's get straight back to it, taking calls with our guest tonight, Daniel Sheehan. Let's go straight to Cornelius in Louisiana. Good evening, Cornelius. Say hi to Daniel Sheehan.
Hello, Mr. Jimmy and Daniel Sheehan. God bless you and yours. I was from the Art Bell days, so I've been with y'all for a while.
Right on.
Yeah, those are the old times. Yeah, right. So, thank you, Cornelius.
I like everything you're saying and stuff, and I can tell the government was trying to cut you off because that's what that interference was, because you're telling the truth. The only thing I have, I believe in biblical prophecy and stuff. The Sunnis and the Shias have a biblical prophecy similar to ours, except it's just in reverse. About the Christ and Antichrist, they're going to say that Christ is going to become Muslim and stuff like that. So I wanted to know what you thought about that, and does that play into your book too with all of this stuff with Israel and the U.S. and the Middle East and stuff, and really with ISIS? And I'll take my answer off the air. God bless you. Jimmy, you're a great host and everything. Daniel, I'm looking for your book.
Thank you, Cornelius.
Thank you, Cornelius. Thank you. Well, no, this is a deep and profound question that Cornelius has asked here about whether or not we believe that the human species is capable of precognition, of really being able to prognosticate about the future, and the then to be able to discern what writings actually are accurate about this, that we're going to be covering a lot of that in the third book. The second book that I'm writing right now is called Rulers of the Realm, which is going to be dealing with a lot of the material that we've been dealing with here tonight,
right,
about this ruling elite behind the scenes.
Well, is it a yes or no question?
It's not really a yes or no question, because there's a deeper question that he's saying is, do I believe that the events that are going on in the Middle East right now are in fact the beginning of the apocalyptic interpretations? I do not believe that's true. But this question about being able to discern certain types of patterns that exist in the culture and project them into the future and to suggest that situations like this could happen,
right,
and could lead to terrible consequences, especially with the Soviet Union now coming back into the play. But I don't believe this is the apocalypse. I do not.
Thank you, Cornelius. Just a great question. Jocelyn in Wisconsin, wild card. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Oh, hi. I really, this is just horrifically just fascinating. But, you know, I believe that they're the cause, these sociopaths are the cause of the First and Second World War and all those people that died. For what? Because of them? Because of the power that they want, and for some sick, you know, that they need, and then all the money, and they're destroying this planet with all, like you were mentioning, with the pesticides and all that. That is driving me crazy. I'm a senior citizen. I just see things getting worse and worse. But I also wanted to ask you, were they involved in the company IG Farben that made the chemicals that gassed the Jewish people?
Thank you, Jocelyn. Thank you.
Yes, Jocelyn. The IG Farben was one of the great cartels that was actually established and maintained by these people and helped finance IG Farben and to rehabilitate IG Farben after the war. So you can look up the history of IG Farben and you find these people all over it. The people that Alan Dulles represented in Germany, some of those major companies in the Sullivan and Cromwell actually represented. In fact, Sullivan and Cromwell represented IG Farben. They were their lawyers.
Let's go to, great question, Jocelyn. Let's go to Mike in Long Island, wild card. Mike, welcome to Coast AM. Mike?
Michael may have fallen asleep.
3, 2, 1. Let's go to Will in Atlanta, Georgia. Will, welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you, sir. Great show. It's so wonderful to hear Christic Institute back in the conversation.
Oh, there we are. Right.
Very, very noble. Very noble effort. But it's a little bit like Dr. Frankenstein complaining about his monster, the snake biting his own tail. Because this fascism that was nailed to the front wall of the U.S. House after the Roman victory of the American Civil War is a symbol of the power and authority of the Roman state. That's the power, the execution instruments that the lictors carried around following the magistrates when they were crucifying tens of thousands of Christs for twice denying Caesar was God. Thomas Jefferson, our founder and prophet, spelled this all out in his letter to his nephew Peter Carr. And what we have to understand is the reason America needs to be destroyed by Gog and Babylon, by the false Jews and Rome, is because of our creedal civil religion, where only God is our sovereign, the creator of the universe. Moses was a real person. The Ark of the Covenant was a capacitor stolen from the Great Pyramid to destroy the Babylonian perversion of pedophilic of Pharaohism. And that's what's going on right now. You can watch Kay Griggs' YouTube interview, a very godly witness. America is the prophetic Israel. If you read Isaiah's prophecy of Zion, which means perfection in Hebrew, only America fulfills the half a dozen signs that Isaiah gives by which we can know who Israel is.
But do you have a question for Daniel really quick?
Yeah. When are you going to give up trying to cover for Rome running Rothschild and Rockefeller as their Vatican Bank and the Federal Reserve? That's why Bush and Cheney did 9/11. That's why George Herbert Walker Bush and Nixon, as Vatican cat's paws, murdered our president to keep us in Vietnam after only 120 of us had died fighting for the 5% Catholics that own 95% of Vietnam's wealth.
But do you have a question?
Yeah, when is he going to give it up and turn away from Gog and Babylon and become an American and fight for God and righteousness?
Got to go. All right, let's go to international. We have Johan in Switzerland. Johan, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. And I wanted to ask your guests, what did Alan Dulles and George Walker Bush have to do with the Kennedy assassination? What's his take on the Kennedy assassination?
I knew that was going to come up at some point tonight, Daniel.
That's going to be a major part of the book, of the one I'm in the process of writing right now, Rulers of the Realm. The short of it all is that Alan Dulles was actually the consigliere for this group of people that were the private investment clients of Brown Brothers Harriman and the law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. These are the key people that greenlighted the assassination of President Kennedy. And Alan Dulles was the field marshal, basically, for the entire program, along with Edward Lansdale, the fellow that I mentioned earlier, that was behind the uncovering of the $1.2 trillion in gold and silver. And one of the things that Kennedy was doing, the bottom line, Kennedy, after after the Cuban Missile Crisis, had in fact resolved that he was going to try to work behind the scenes with Khrushchev to disassemble all of the nuclear warheads of the United States and have the Soviet Union disassemble all of their warheads, and was going to have Pope John the 23rd, be the broker of the deal to make sure that both sides complied with this. And at the same time, he also issued Executive Order 11111, which was ordering the printing of $4 billion in silver and gold certificates to try to basically do away with the Federal Reserve Bank. These two moves on the part of Kennedy got him killed, and it was Alan Dulles and his people that did it, not in his capacity as the former frustrated CIA director, because Kennedy had threatened to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds, but in his capacity as the consigliere for these particular major robber barons.
Thank you for the call, Johan.
All right.
Let's go to Jim in West Palm Beach, Florida. First-time caller. Jim, welcome to Coast AM.
Hi. What an interesting show. Thank you, gentlemen. By the way, interesting, just a 99 look balloon that reminds me of Soldier March, the great World War II Dutch movie. Anyway, Mr. Sheehan, believe it or not, I spent 10 years working with Jesuits at Innisfata. My question is a two-part question. Number one, was this irresponsible invasion of Iraq? Did they have any clue what was the Shia Cheney? Did they have any clue what they were doing with the Kurds, the Shias, and the Sunnis? That's number one. And number two, are we now trying to pit the Sunnis against the Shias? Thank you.
Thank you for the call, okay. Jim. Did you pick up all of that, Daniel?
I got it.
Okay.
The bottom line is that, no, the people like Dick Cheney in the Bushes and George Herbert Walker and these fellas, they just plow right straight forward. They don't feel that they need to understand the subtleties of the Islamic faith. They don't need to understand the difference in Shia and Sunnis. They don't even know the difference between them. That their dedication is to maximizing the profits of this 1% of the people that are the corporate robber barons. And so that I don't believe that at all that they understood the subtleties of it any more than Churchill did when he superimposed the artificial boundaries, completely disregarding all of the different religious differences and tribal differences. So in right now, because of that, they don't really know that these people don't really know what to do about this conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis. They shift back and forth. In one part, they support the Sunnis against the Shias, and sometimes they support the Shias, as they did, for example, in Iraq, to put in the new government was all Shia government, and then they started suppressing the Sunnis. What these are like is people, carpenters or amateur carpenters who try to saw off the legs of a table without measuring them. You know, and they're going to chop the legs off until there's no legs left on the table. That's why we have to get these people out of power, that they don't really understand history. They don't understand religious subtleties. They don't understand anything except raw greed and power. And that's why they have to be gotten out of here. So I don't believe that they are going to be able to play off the Shia against the Sunnis. And I don't believe that they were even cognizant of those subtleties when they went in there.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to Pat, east of the Rockies, out in Minneapolis. Pat, welcome to Coast AM.
I've studied a lot of interesting points, like, let's say, Saddam Hussein really wasn't Muslim. He thought he was the reincarnation of King Nebuchadnezzar from the Bible. And whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I have misgivings about our presidential candidates all gathered together in one convenient spot. I see these power players as not being above running a helicopter or a small plane or a drone into a building while they're all gathered together. Is this the kind of tactic that they resort to when they get bored with the meetings and the papers and the signings and the sneaking and the lies, and they just like to go boom?
Wow, Pat, you think.
No, I don't think that they're that reckless. I think that they're much more conniving and focused on things. I don't think that they're going to wipe out the candidates. It's just because the candidates are basically working for them.
Seems like a good tactic, though, if you have too many monkey wrenches and wild cards thrown in there, like Trump and Sanders. And if it seems like it's getting inconveniently out of control, wouldn't that be a tempting target?
Well, I think they'll do it a different way. What they'll do is that, for example, if Trump were to succeed in winning Iowa and New Hampshire and in South Carolina and started winning these primaries, what you would see is that the regular Republican Party would refuse to forward Republican money to him. Now, the question is, does he have enough money to be able to run his campaign without them? That's one of the unique qualities of Trump, much like with Ross Perot when they did it. But I don't think that this 1%, the people that I'm talking about here, the rulers of the realm, I don't think that they're going to be, assassinating the people that are candidates. What they will do is they'll figure out ways of cutting off the power.
That is threats. Ross Perot, the second time he ran, he said he quit because of threats around the time of his daughter's wedding. And I think other people have been threatened, either with revealing things that they don't want to be revealed. That's one reason I think Sandra Day O'Connor voted the way she voted during that election recount in Florida and then immediately quit. Either I think they can either threat, they'll reveal something about her past or her husband's past, and I think they also use other kinds of threats. against family members. Do.
Yep. Thank you for
they
the
do.
Call, Pat. You're absolutely
they
right.
Do, Pat. And, no, you're right. And we're very familiar with this thing with Ross. I know that that's, it's interesting that you're aware of that. The thing that's got to his daughter.
I know. I'm trying to get everything in here. Let's go to Steve in Fort Lauderdale. Steve, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, gentlemen. I'll be real quick. I want to get back to the timeline, historical timeline that ended with the Osama bin Laden trying to remove the U.S. military presence from the Middle East. And you mentioned that he was involved with the Mujahideen, which was his troops in Afghanistan, but then you sort of overlapped it with the Muslim Brotherhood. And I was wondering if you could clarify that a little bit. I got confused.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Steve.
One more question real quick.
Sure.
You finish up the storyline of what the tonight was about and touch real quick on the formation of ISIS. That's it.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
Okay.
We've got literally 2 minutes, Daniel.
Okay.
Give it your best shot.
I'll just do a quickie. The Mujahideen was a particular term that was being used by the Western forces, again, to try to characterize some small subgroup of the fundamentalist Islamists. The fundamentalist Islamists, the major movement of them is the Muslim Brotherhood, who are Sunnis. Okay, and that they constitute the vast majority of the people in Saudi Arabia and other countries, that they're the one that are going to be rising into the major positions of power in there. And so that's what's going on over there. Now, I don't think we have control over that. I think that ultimately the U.S. military forces have to just withdraw from the whole area. And the fact that there's a Sunni and a Shia conflict that goes on has been going on for 500 years. So we just got to get out of there and get out of the crossfire of that civil war and get ready to lose control over the kind of magnates that we put into power back in 1922. Just get out of there.
Now, one last question, and this comes off of Twitter, and you've got 30 seconds. Should we accept Syrian refugees when we could be running the potential risk of a Trojan horse situation?
Well, the fact of the matter is I do believe that when people come through the legal process of trying to come into the country, there is a long 2-year period of a fairly intense vetting of them. That it's very different than what's happening in Europe, where people are flooding in by the thousands and there's no administrative procedures for really taking care of them. That's a very dangerous situation that they have, and I have no doubt whatsoever that they're going to take advantage of it. The people who are engaged in the jihad to get the Europeans out of the Middle Eastern oil fields. But I don't think it's going to be the same problem in the United States. I think that we're perfectly capable of taking refugees into the United States and sending them through a deep process. I'm more concerned about some of the people that are already here.
Right.
Seem to be being intrigued by these people and going over and getting training and coming back with they're already American citizens.
Daniel, thank you so much. Had a great conversation tonight. Absolutely enlightening. I'd like to thank Nathan, G, George, Lisa, Chris, Lex, and Tommy. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. I'll see you guys next time. Behave. Go Beckley Tepe.